sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Phil Blazer, founder and CEO of the Jewish Life Television Network, publisher of the National Jewish News, rescuer of Ethiopian Jews, and winner of the 2017 Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan Memorial Foundation Award of Service to the Jewish People. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Hanukkah, that long, lovely holiday, has now receded into our rearview mirrors for the 5778 year. Its light lingering long after, and we are now entering the home stretch of the season's greetings period, which means all Christmas carols all the time in grocery stores, malls, airports, restaurants, TV commercials, radio channels, and as general background music for our secular American society. Now, there are two funny parts about this. The first is that the songs are all celebrating the theoretical birthday of a Jewish baby boy. That's right, for anyone as yet unaware of the fact, Jesus was Jewish, which means that every carol and seasonal jingle you're listening to or singing along with is a joyous commemoration of the birth of a Jewish kid a long time ago. Odd, no? The other funny, ironic aspect to all of these Christmas carols being played is that a lot of them, I mean a lot of them, were actually written by Jewish composers and lyricists. In truth, as a rabbi, I'm not exactly a fan of Jews writing or singing Christmas songs. You know, the Neil Diamond Christmas album, the Barbara Streisand Christmas Festival of Schmaltzy Song, the Mandy Patinkin Yule Special, the All-Yiddish Carol Album. Give me a break. Who do you think they're fooling here? But still, first of all, unless somebody has changed the formula, Christmas celebrates the birth of a Jew in Israel, born to a Jewish mother, even if there is some debate about his dad. So if Jews want to write songs about it, I guess we have at least as much of a right to do so as anybody else. And the truth is that more than half of the most famous and popular Christmas songs in America were written or co-written by Jews. While I agree that isn't a particularly good thing necessarily, it's pretty clear that without Jews, American Christians wouldn't be able to properly celebrate their own holiday. Here's just a brief list of some Christmas songs written by Jews. The Christmas song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, was written by Mel Torme and Robert Wells, whose birth name was Robert Levinson. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer by Robert May and Johnny Marks. White Christmas by Irving Berlin, who, by the way, also wrote Easter Parade. Santa Claus is Coming to Town by J. Fred Coots. Let It Snow by Sammy Kahn and Julie Stein. It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year by George Weil, whose real name was Bernard Weissman. Silver Bells by Jay Livingston, born Jacob Harold Levinson. I'll Be Home for Christmas by Walter Kent and Buck Ram, whose real name was Samuel Ram, which was shortened from something longer and Eastern European, like Ramshinsky. Winter Wonderland by Felix Bernard. Sleigh Ride by Mitchell Parrish, whose born name was Michael Hyman Paschalinski. And there's a whole bunch more contemporary songs, like Santa Baby, Holly Jolly Christmas, and Rockin' Round the Christmas Tree. With all of these Jewish contributions, I'm beginning to wonder if Christians can actually write a decent Christmas song. Even songs that aren't exactly about Christmas, like Frank Lesser's Baby It's Cold Outside, have become standards of the season, and they were also written by Jews. Now, if only these wonderful Jewish talents had directed themselves to composing popular Jewish music for Rosh Hashanah or Purim, Sukkot, Pesach, Shabbat, well, then we'd have some truly wonderful popular Jewish holiday songs. Or, well, they could have just written some better Hanukkah songs. I can imagine them now. Latkes bubbling in a frying pan, candles lighting up the room, klezmer music being played by the band, my parents' friends Max and Sadie Bloom. Okay, maybe not. Anyway, the truth is that our Christian friends should probably be thanking Jewish composers and lyricists for saving Christmas from all of those deadly old carols about King Wenceslaus. Who was he, anyway? And three Orient kings sung in weird minor modes. If not for Jewish songwriters, Christmas might become, well, a silent night. In that questionable spirit, and to play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a ridiculous and heartwarming parody of Mariah Carey's very popular seasonal song, All I Want for Christmas Is Jews.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come true. All I want for Christmas is Jews. Yeah.
Was a timely, if very silly, version of All I Want for Christmas Is Jews, just for Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Phil Blazer, founded the first national Jewish radio show, the first national Jewish newspaper, and the first national Jewish television network. He was also a key player in saving hundreds of Ethiopian Jews who were stranded in Sudan and bringing them to safety in Israel. Phil Blazer has had an extraordinary career. He is the winner of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for service to the Jewish people. He'll be here with us when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker.
And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Phil Blazer is the CEO and founder and creative driving force of Jewish Life Television, the only 24/7 TV network. It reaches 45 million homes. He is also the recipient of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award, the Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for service to the Jewish people in the area both of rescue and of information and education. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, but you could listen to it, tape it, and hear it in the evening.
Yes, I guess so. This is still a morning show, but if people are podcasting this in the evening, then we have to say good evening to them as well. Phil, you know, being a Jewish media tycoon is not necessarily what everybody's parents wanted for them. How did you end up on this course?
I went to Van Nuys High School in the middle of the San Fernando Valley, California. And there was an English teacher who was an announcer in his previous vocation. And I found the thought of a radio speech class to be rather unique. So I went to the local radio station. The first FM station in the valley was in San Fernando, California, adjacent to the valley, and got a job at the age of 17 through that class that I took, which we did War of the Worlds. One of the stars of the class was Stacy Keach, who became a rather substantial...
Famous actor.
And we produced, as I said, War of the Worlds. And from there, I went to the local station and got a job on Sundays playing tapes and announcing a very short period of time on each program. But I was enlightened with radio, and I still am today, because you don't know what you're looking at. You don't know how to see it. And the mystery of that makes for great media, which is radio.
It's so creative, and I feel the same way. You started your Jewish radio program, I believe, in 1965, the Jewish Soul radio program. You were in Minnesota, Minneapolis?
Yes, I went to the University of Minnesota, and they still haven't won a bowl game.
It's only been 50 years. Give it a little time. The station you were... The station manager, it actually was a guy named Wolfman Jack, who became extremely famous in America as, you know, sort of the radio guy for rock and roll for a long time. How did you decide to do a Jewish radio program?
I went to Israel when I was 17, besides other things I did at that particular age. But going to Israel made the difference, and I had some experience with radio, as I said, in the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
But I transferred that love of music, which is basically rhythm, blues, and jazz. There was no Jewish program in Minneapolis. In fact, there was rarely a Jewish program anywhere, except for New York.
Still not overwhelmingly common, I can say from our experience.
No, but again, it's enlightening, and it's a special media. So I went to work running the station with Bob Smith. Bob Smith was Wolfman Jack, who became an icon on late night radio. And there I was, foisted in the Minneapolis dormitory at the University of Minnesota, working during the day, selling advertising, and loved being around radio. But all of a sudden, something happened. We started the first, Bob Smith and I, radio station with rhythm and blues music. There was no rhythm and blues. There was what we called chicken radio. Chicken radio is basically radio without Detroit without R&B.
Yeah.
And I could see one day that there was a need for a Jewish radio program, something cool, not something old, something old and new. And I went to Bob Smith and sat down with him one day and said, look at Bob, there's a dream I have. Oh, yeah, I said, Phil, what is that dream? I said, I want to have a soulful Jewish radio program here in Minneapolis. And that would be a dream come true. I always exaggerated, became rather emotional over everything. I still do. It's just my nature, I guess.
It's very Jewish, by the
very
way.
Very Jewish, yes, exactly. And Bob Smith said, take 10 to noon on Sundays and do what you want. Now, I cleaned up about 74 bleeps, expletives, because except for me, I was a goody two-shoes. The station was made up of tough guys. Like, I would record my show on Friday mornings, okay, right when I got done with my last class at the University of Minnesota, and a woman would bring her little son to watch me tape the show, because it was always taped. That was Prince. Prince actually came and listened to my show as I recorded it with his mother.
Wow.
And that's kind of connects with his propensity to know more about culture. And he wasn't just a rhythm and blues black African-American singer. He had a predisposition to ethnic groups.
We will continue with Phil Blazer, the winner of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award, when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, akfetch or akfel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Anti-Semitism, to me, is in the soil of Europe. Even if you think that there's nothing growing at the moment, trust me, it's going to come back. It has returned, and people think about the anti-Semitic acts and really brutal violence that's taken place in places like France or even England. But there's now a resurgence of anti-Semitism in a place where there aren't nearly as many Jews as there used to be, Eastern Europe.
You know, we as Americans tend to generalize about Europe in kind of a crazy way. We talk about Europe this or European that. And Europe is a bunch of different cultures with very different languages and histories. And it is far less homogeneous than even North America, even if we count Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Europe is more diverse and has very different histories. And one of the great dividing lines is what was once part of the Roman Empire and what wasn't. Another one of the great dividing lines is the Catholic south and east of Europe versus the Protestant north west of Europe. Another great dividing line within the Christian world is between Orthodox, Cyrillic written Christianity,
and Roman
which
Catholic,
has its head right in Constantinople, and Roman Catholic Latin-based Christianity, which has its seat in Rome, in the Vatican. I mean, there are all these very fundamental dividing lines, which we tend to ignore. So when we talk about a resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe, let's be pretty clear that we're really not talking about the Protestant countries. We're not talking about Finland, Sweden, Norway, which have occasionally been guilty of isolated anti-Semitic incidents, but never of massive pogroms or the Holocaust or anything like that. We're not talking about Holland or Denmark. Even England, since the very early parts of its history, has been largely free of violent, like really gross forms of anti-Semitism, because in England, the Catholic Church has taken a back seat to the Protestant Church of England, which the monarch has to be and represent and is the head of. But Eastern Europe is a whole nother story. Parts of Eastern Europe are, in fact, Orthodox, and parts are Roman Catholic. Like Poland, Hungary are overwhelmingly Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic, right?
What's happening there is that people are disappointed and disoriented by the transition from communism to capitalism. Their pensions, which were once meaningful, have become meaningless. Older people in particular are often in desperate straits. Younger people can't find jobs, so they take, either they leave and they go to other parts of the European Union further west to look for work,
right,
or they take jobs that we wouldn't want our children to have. All kinds of sleazy and unsavory positions in sleazy and unsavory industries. So when there's an economic crisis, people tend to look for a scapegoat. And so some people will blame right-wing governments and faulty economic policies, and others will blame liberals or the eternal scapegoat, which is the Jewish conspiracy, which is undermining the success or the transition of a country like Hungary or Poland. So, you know, Poland probably is more anti-Semitic now than at any time since 1945, largely because of economic troubles.
It's distressing because, you know, I was in Poland just a couple of years ago, and I could wear my yarmulke there where I wouldn't wear it in Italy or France or even England, in many neighborhoods. And it's, you know, kind of sad to see this recurrence of anti-Semitism.
Right.
Hopefully, we can hope it gets better. Thanks, Tom.
Look forward to seeing you next week.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri, representing the Weintraub Israel Center and representing Israel here in America. Boker Tov. So there's a holiday that most Americans are celebrating, but most American Jews are not, which starts tonight, Christmas. It actually seems to have started about 6 months ago. You don't have that same experience in Israel, although, Chen, you have an interesting history with Christmas yourself for a nice Jewish girl from not too far from Ben Gurion Airport.
Yeah, it's really hard to find Christmas in Israel. But, however, given the fact that globalization is happening and you are aware of what's going on in the Western world out here in America, I was exposed to Christmas from different shows and a little bit on the internet, and I was very excited. And as a little girl, I really, really, really wanted to see Christmas. So I would force my dad to take me to Nazareth, the only place where you can see Christmas in Israel. And I would make him buy me chocolate Santas and see the trees, and I would love it. And I didn't even realize it wasn't like a Jewish holiday. I mean, I was like, why don't we celebrate it?
And so you didn't even realize it was a religious holiday.
No, I didn't. I was like, it's just a cool holiday for people in Nazareth.
Very funny. I mean, it's actually, no, I think a lot of Americans think about Christmas as a secular holiday. A lot of believing Christians think that way. But Tamir, you grew up in a moshav, you know, very different kind of environment. And I was asking you about, like, you know, what was your experience of people of other religious cultures? You talked about one family in particular.
So in my family, in my moshav, there is a family that come from Finland. And one of the girls there is a really good friend of mine. And so I got to see the family a lot. And they live in this big house that is like multi-generational. And it's so great to see how they're all like sitting together all the time.
So how did they end up in your moshav coming from Finland?
So that's an interesting question. I thought of that a lot until one day I had the courage to ask. And the grandma told me that they had a company for traveling, and they chose that they really, really like Israel, and they really like traveling in Israel, and they have a lot of knowledge. So they moved all the way to Israel, opened a company for Finnish people to travel in Israel. And right now their business is very successful. And I got to see a lot of like Finnish tours getting into my moshav, sitting in their house and having dinner. One day I even got some chairs and tables for them. And it's really, really cool because it's a connection to Israel that I wasn't exposed to before, and it's very special and unique, and the Finnish people are just so amazing. I had a friend that is Finnish, and I had two campers, if I can call it like that, that are Finnish because I was their counselor, and they were just so nice and so polite and so respectful. And they celebrate Christmas also, so one day I was invited to go to their Christmas, and I saw a Christmas tree, and I sat with them for a little while just to see what's going on, how to celebrate Christmas in Israel as a Christian, and it was really interesting.
You know, it's fascinating because I think it hasn't been very long that there's been a Jewish majority culture in which people were just not aware of the holidays of so many, what we tend to think of as, you know, there it's a tiny minority. And the same is probably true for the Muslims. You know, you're aware of the fact that they have holidays, but it's not your culture. It's not something that everybody experiences.
Right.
They say in Israel, Kulanu Yehudim, you know, everybody's Jewish. It's not exactly true, but it kind of feels that way.
Feels that way when you're in Israel, definitely.
Thanks so much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Yetta goes to see her rabbi, and she is very, very angry. She tells him she wants to divorce her husband. Why? What's the matter? Asks the rabbi. I have a strong suspicion he's not the father of our youngest child. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As a child who grew up with progressive myopia, I often wondered just what true vision was. While my terrible eyesight was fortunately correctable with contacts and glasses and later LASIK, I was always acutely aware of the fact that human vision can be extremely limited. We see only as far ahead as our eyes can focus, and even with 20/20 vision, those eyes aren't able to see clearly more than a little ways ahead. That simple fact is highly relevant in our Torah portion of Vayechi. This week in Temple, we will read the final parsha, the last portion of the book of Genesis, which concludes the passing of two great figures. The first, our patriarch Jacob, concludes a long and complicated life by conveying a series of interesting blessings on his children, which are really a mix of predictions, praise, and criticism. The second passing, Jacob's son Joseph, dies at the end of our portion, having moved our people to a new and adventurous phase that will prove to be pivotal for our history. The passings of these great founders of our people are rich in both beauty and irony. Beauty for the ways that faith has triumphed over the vicissitudes of life and the challenges of troubled families, and irony for the fact that neither patriarch can truly envision the future God has in store for his descendants. The positive lesson from the lives of both Jacob and Joseph was that ultimately faith in God was triumphant. In spite of the wavering course life can take, there is ultimately both chen and chesed, both grace and kindness available to us in this world. To succeed in spite of all, as Jacob and Joseph did, we must trust in God's ultimate justice and providence. But it is also true that there's a hard limit to human knowledge and foresight. Even the best of us, even true prophets, can never really see the future clearly. As we approach the last week of the secular year, when predictions for the year to come will be rampant, may we remember that in the final analysis, our lives are always in God's hands. Like Jacob and Joseph, we seek to advance our own plans for success for our families and our beliefs. Like Jacob and Joseph, we hope, with God's help, to weather the storms of life. And like our patriarchs, we know that it's God's plan, not ours, that will be implemented. We can only see a little ways ahead and not always so clearly. After that, it is all up to God. May we continue to work to create holiness in this world, and may we have faith in this coming final week of the secular year and at all times in God's ultimate justice and mercy. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Phil Blazer, founder of the Jewish Life Television Network, among many other accomplishments, and the winner of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for Service to the Jewish People, will be here. He'll explain how he got his start in radio, what Wolfman Jack had to do with it, and how eventually he came to start the first Jewish television network. Find out all of that and much more when we come back in a moment, right here on To Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Trump has threatened to cut off financial aid to countries that voted for the UN resolution rejecting Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital last week. Trump also expressed support for a letter sent by U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley, in which he warned member states against supporting the resolution. The president will be watching this vote carefully, has requested that I report back on those who voted against us, Haley wrote. Trump said he likes Haley's message that he is indeed watching the votes. They take hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, and then they vote against us, Trump said. Well, we're watching those votes. Let them vote against us. We'll save a lot. We don't care. Nikki Haley sent a letter to representatives of UN member states warning them against supporting the resolution. The resolution passed the UN by a large majority, of course. In an attempt to avoid embarrassment, Israel instructed its diplomatic missions to seek meetings with high-level officials to try to persuade them to direct their representatives at the UN to oppose, not support the resolution, or at the very least, not to deliver a speech in support of it at the General Assembly. Among the reasons the Israeli ambassadors cited are that Jerusalem was the de facto capital of Israel long before the U.S. recognized it as such. That's certainly true. That a resolution of this kind at the U.N. will damage American efforts towards a peace agreement in the region. The resolution will spur terror and violence in the area. Yes. And unilateral steps in the U.N. do more harm than good. Pretty much always. The envoys also pledged to maintain freedom of religion and the status quo in the city, which is also true. In other news, Canada's global pharmaceutical giant Apotex confirmed the death of its billionaire founder, Barry Sherman. Police reported two suspicious deaths at the couple's upscale Toronto home. Barry and his wife, Honey Sherman, prominent Canadians. The death of Barry and his wife, Honey Sherman, prominent Canadians, sparked an outpouring of grief among the country's political elite and its Jewish community. They were found strangled in their upscale home. The Apotex company made its name producing generic drugs. It has grown to employ more than 11,000 people worldwide. Barry Sherman was a billionaire. He and his wife donated tens of millions to Jewish and other humanitarian causes. Those people are not usually murdered. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he was saddened by news of the sudden passing of Barry and Honey Sherman. He spoke of the vision and spirit of the couple known for their philanthropy. Linda Fromm, a member of the Canadian Senate, said she was gutted by the loss of the couple 2 weeks after presenting a Canadian Senate medal to one of the kindest and most beloved members of Canada's Jewish community. They were remarkable people, said Bob Ray, former premier of Ontario province. I'm grappling with this terrible news.
Canadian media said the Shermans recently put their home up for sale for $5 million as they were moving to a larger one. Forbes lists Sherman as one of the country's richest men with a net worth of $3 billion. Barry and Honey Sherman were major philanthropists and active leaders of the Canadian Jewish community, and their shocking deaths are now being investigated as suspicious by Canadian police. President Trump commuted the sentence of Shalom Rubashkin, chief executive of what was once the largest kosher slaughterhouse in the country. He was convicted of bank fraud and money laundering. Trump cited appeals from across the political spectrum when he made the move. In 2009, he was convicted of bank fraud and sentenced thereafter to 27 years in prison, the White House said. Mr. Rubashkin has now served more than 8 years of that sentence, which many have called excessive in light of its disparity with sentences imposed for similar crimes. The White House statement described the commutation as an action encouraged by bipartisan leaders from across the political spectrum, from Nancy Pelosi to Orrin Hatch. Attached to this statement was a long list of lawmakers from both parties who backed Rubashkin's release, as well as former top-ranking Justice Department officials from both parties as well. This action is not a presidential pardon, the statement said. It does not vacate Mr. Rubashkin's conviction. It leaves in place a term of supervised release and a substantial restitution obligation, which were also part of Mr. Rubashkin's sentence. A massive federal immigration raid in 2008 at the agriprocessor's meatpacking plant in Postville, Iowa, reported here on Too Jewish, of course, led to the arrest of nearly 400 undocumented Guatemalans and Mexican workers. Rubashkin was charged a year later on the bank fraud and money laundering charges as he tried to sell the company, which was then on the verge of bankruptcy. Advocates for Rubashkin, among them prominent legal and political figures, later offered evidence that they said showed prosecutors tampered inappropriately with the case. They provided affidavits showing prosecutors scared off potential buyers, saying they would seize the company if a Rubashkin family member were involved in the purchase. As the company's value plummeted, Rubashkin masked its poor financial health, leading to the criminal charges, according to the argument. Rubashkin, a member of Chabad, is 57 years old. He has 10 children, which Trump noted in his commutation. Billionaire Hershey Freeman of Montreal ultimately purchased the meatpacking plant in 2009, rebranded it as AgriStar Meat and Poultry. Finally, a St. Louis man and disgraced former journalist was sentenced to 5 years in prison for making bomb threats against Jewish institutions as part of a revenge plot against a former girlfriend. Juan Thompson was sentenced last week in Manhattan federal court. Judge Kevin Castell said he was exceeding the recommended prison sentence. That's unusual due to the level of intensity, the maliciousness of Juan Thompson's crimes. Castell said Thompson had committed domestic terrorism. In court, Thompson's ex-girlfriend, Francesca Rossi, said he had abused her during and after their relationship and attempted to frame her as a child pornographer and drug dealer, in addition to making bomb threats against Jewish institutions in her name. "I feared for my life every day," she said. Thompson was fired from the Intercept News website last year for ethics breaches, pled guilty in June to cyber-stalking charges in connection with 8 threats against Jewish sites, including JCC's and the ADL. Federal prosecutors said the threats were copycat crimes during the wave of nearly 150 bomb threats experienced by Jewish institutions during the first 3 months of 2017. Nearly 3 weeks after Thompson's arrest, an Israeli-American teen, a disturbed one, was arrested in Israel for allegedly making the bulk of the threats. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Phil Blazer is the CEO, founder and CEO of Jewish Life Television, the only 24/7 Jewish programming TV network in the country, available in 45 million homes. He won the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award this year for work in 2 areas: rescue for his work saving Ethiopian Jews, particularly in Operation Joshua in the 1980s, and for information and education, where he worked effectively in 3 separate media: his Jewish Soul radio program, which we talked about earlier, his publisher and founder of the National Jewish News, and the founder and driving force of Jewish Life Television. Phil, you had the radio show Jewish Soul, and then you began to, then you moved into publishing a newspaper. Tell us how that came about.
Well, having the radio program, which I had for about I hosted for a good 40 years. I envisioned the need to have a print newspaper. There was two Jewish newspapers here in Los Angeles, which underscores the fact that Los Angeles is the creative, in my estimation, location on the dial. If you found anything creative and profound and new, different, it's Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles. We include Hollywood and Beverly Hills in that mix.
You have to.
But there's always something new going on in Southern California. And so I started printing a newspaper that focused on the geography of the San Fernando Valley, where my radio show was. If you recall, I came and did my radio program in San Fernando Valley. Then eventually the dream was how to expand into radio, television, pardon me, TV. And that was the next step.
Television, you know, was sort of the shining orb. It's the star media, you could say, of the 20th century, last half of the 20th century. Not an easy thing to set up a TV network. Tell us about the difficulty of doing it and the accomplishment.
Having friends. Having friends who were in the television business or in business. And it wasn't easy. And it's very difficult today even. But it's a message about our people that if you set your sights on something, a foundation, a television network, whatever it is, the Jewish people don't give up. They really don't. We're different in a very lovely way. Because when it comes, let's say, just to charity, to Sadaka, here in the greater Los Angeles area, 80% of the charity comes from the Jewish community. 80%. Remarkable. So as we're sitting here talking and chatting and kibitzing, I think about the fact that the tape that we used to record on was 2 inches.
Yeah.
Now it's not even, you can't even see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's digital. So for somebody like me at my age, I can't comprehend how all the new fangdangos are moving around the system. Because you can have a television station in a cigar box.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's true even more so for radio, but everything has become so fast. But the content is still what really matters, isn't it?
Oh, yes. But there's plenty of content around. I have 2,000 programs on tape, and we're recodifying them now with some great people like Mickey Katz and modern entertainers. David Steinberg, who used to host The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson took a day off.
Yeah, we still here on Too Jewish play his biblical comedic monologues from time to time. They're fantastic. Brilliant comedian.
Especially the ones on Moses.
Yes. Although the one on Noah is pretty good, and they're all good.
Not a true story, though.
Well, no.
What enlightened you? Let me turn the tables just for a minute.
Sure.
What got you to take the task of doing it?
Of doing a radio show? You know, it's a funny story. I've told it on Too Jewish before, but not for a long time. We were getting ads for the synagogue on radio and other media, and a friend of mine in advertising said, you know, you could do a radio show. And I said, you know, I'd been on radio a fair number of times. I'd been on TV, little spots about holidays and things like that. And I said, oh, sure. And then I got a call as I was about to go on vacation. You're starting August 1st. I said, I'm starting what? He says, you have an hour on Sunday mornings, and you have 13 weeks scheduled. And I said, for what? He said, for your radio show. And so I had about a month to figure out what we were doing. And at first we were going to call it Deli Home Companion, but we thought, you know, it might cause some legal problems. And eventually we came up with Too Jewish, and we've now been doing it for 15, 16 years. I just think Judaism has so much exciting, interesting, and diverse to offer, like what you put on JLTV, that there's always content, there's always something to talk about, there's always interesting people to talk to. Phil, when you started JLTV, did you envision it as a full network, you know, providing 24 hours programming 7 days a week?
I think I focused on the one word, which was culture. Not that I poo-pooed or have religion, not at all. But it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it extends itself what we've been able to do at JLTV into all facets. JLTV is, it's been a treat for me in my career.
One of the beautiful aspects, I think, about the work you do is that, as you said, you include culture, but you do so in the broadest sense. Mordechai Kaplan said Judaism is a civilization, so you have comedy, you have music, you have spirituality, Kabbalah, you have activism on behalf of Israel and on behalf of the Jewish community. How do you decide what to program?
First of all, I don't have the patience, the time, or the will to learn Kabbalah. So I put that over here on this side of the table. But
and yet you have a program on it.
Yeah, we do, because there's so many facets of Jewish life. Let's say there's 6 million Jews living in America, there's 7 million Jews living in Israel, and there's almost 20 million all total. That piece of math reminds us that there are 20 million different types of Jews.
Yes.
Each of us walk around the globe marching to a different person, religion. It's us, individualistic as it can be. It's a remarkable, fun, exciting, with or without Kabbalah, avocation. What a wonderful thing, you know, to be able to enjoy life like you. I see you smile about what you're doing in Tucson. It's a great treat. It's a great treat to the audience, Jewish and non-Jewish. There's a purpose. The first purpose is not to enlighten people. It's to have fun, right?
Absolutely. To enjoy life. You know, we say l'chaim, to life, right? That's not to suffer, but to enjoy the richness that's available. You've had some extraordinary experiences in advocacy and rescue also. Tell us a little bit about Operation Joshua. People may know Operation Solomon, Operation Moses, the rescue of the Ethiopian Jews, but this is an interesting story and you were key to it.
Well, it starts in my offices of my newspaper and radio program. Howard Lentoff, a professor at UC Irvine, was an ardent activist to rescue Ethiopian Jews. Older Jews living in even the enlightened greater Los Angeles area couldn't comprehend a black Jew.
I remember.
There were a few dozen living in Chicago that were self-converted, probably, not important about that part of the story. But the first thing I did was interview Howard, like you and I are talking here, and learning on the air, what are the Ethiopian Jews like? And are they real? First of all, we said to the word falasha was the original name of what we called.
I remember when we called them falasha.
And then we found out that that was a
derogatory,
word.
Yeah, derogatory, it's an insulting word. Name.
Insulting right. name. As insulting as you can get. So we changed the dialogue to Ethiopian Jew. Now, one of the things that got me excited about it is there wasn't too many people getting involved, you know, with this rescue. And that was probably the end of the 70s, I'm guessing. So that opportunity that God gave me to step into this activism started in the decades before. And then there was nothing really happening for a while. Then all of a sudden, right. Operation Moses sprung up.
Right.
Money was raised by Jews from America, basically.
Yeah, I remember being a cantor in a synagogue, and they were doing a big appeal for Ethiopian
exactly.
Jews in the mid-80s.
So about 15,000 black Jews got out of Ethiopia through nefarious ways, using chartered aircraft through Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. And that became then a major project and was supposed to be hush-hush, shoo-shoo, as they say in the rescue missions dealing with Israel. So these people that worked so diligently to rescue
the Ethiopian Jews, got them to Khartoum, the refugee camps.
And then what happened is, I'll leave this part of the actual rescue that was going on before my real involvement
right.
out of the picture, because somebody in government in Israel, whose name I won't use, leaked the secret story. Operation and blew the whole thing out for Yichus,
for credit.
Credit. And it would take the black Jews from Ethiopia to Sudan, where they were picked up, 6 weeks, a six-week jaunt to get on an airplane to get to Israel. And what happened eventually was that 1,000 black Jews were stuck in the pipeline. Kind of hard to explain, but it's a number thing. So people forgot when it was ceased, the operation ceased because of the leak, that there is a pipeline. There are people on the way, 1,000. Eventually 500 died, and 500 were rescued by Operation Joshua, which was an operation that was I was able to specifically write a letter to Ronald Reagan, which was delivered by a Republican and a Democratic senator. They took it around to each of the 50 members of the Senate, and we were able to get the U.S. government, not the Israeli government, but the United States of America, which shows how things have changed.
Yeah.
How beautiful government can be, because it probably was the greatest thing besides family that happened in my career, I'll share with you now. Vice President Bush flew to Sudan and made a deal to buy the lives of the remaining Jews, which ended up being about 500, like 473, whatever the number is.
The surviving ones in the pipeline.
The surviving ones in the pipeline, yeah. And the moment in time that I refer to was that when I get a call through my secretary then that the Vice President of the United States is on the phone. He wants to talk to you. Mr. Vice President, how are you? It's Phil Blazer. And George Bush says, in 45 minutes, over 500 black Jews will be arriving in Israel.
Fantastic.
And I still hear that voice. It's another advantage of the radio, you know.
Right.
There it comes back again with the aura of how you can motivate through the radio airwaves. But that was, and I've been able, I don't say it's me, it's my friends, it's America, it's Israel, to fight the Nazis in Skokie and all these other things that we've done along the way. It's invigorating. I selfishly say, I've been very lucky, very fortunate.
We are very lucky to have you here on Two Jewish. Mazel tov again on receiving the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for 2017, and continue to do the great work. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
I will try.
You and your family.
Thank you. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish when our guest will be Ruby Namdar, author of the extraordinary new novel, The Ruined House. He's great. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website, voted top 10 podcasts in North America by Moment Magazine. Our playout this morning is a parody of the great Jewish songwriter Frank Lesser's seasonal classic, Baby, It's Cold Outside, in a Jewish mother's version. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Jeremy, what are you wearing?
They're called clothes, Mom.
You know it's 2 degrees outside, right?
I'm aware.
Oy vey.
I heard your oy vey.
Well, honey, it's cold outside.
It's kind of cliche.
Sweetheart, it's cold outside.
I'm not giving in.
You're showing way too much
so
skin.
So let me go.
Just looking at you makes me feel cold.
Mothers are supposed to.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.